Okay, good. All right, I'm going to, I think most of us have been here for the other two classes. I'm going to not do a lot of review tonight. Just going to hit a couple of slides to help us get back into the thinking. We're looking at the period of time between the Testaments, roughly 400 years, four centuries. Just think of that in terms of American history. That would be back into the 1600s. Different times, obviously, but when the Bible ends roughly in around 400 B.C., what we see is the Jews have come back into Palestine, about 40,000 of them by count, have come back into Palestine. They have later on rebuilt the temple, the worship, and the walls of Jerusalem. The worship had been restored under Ezra and successors. This remnant was in back into the promised land, and the world was ruled by the Persians. So a good just tag for your mental thinking is 500 B.C., dominant power was the Persians. It started out as the Medo-Persian Empire. By 500 B.C., the Persians were dominant, and that dynasty remained in place for about another 350 years. It was in the ancient times. As the New Testament begins, which we would say late 1st century B.C., the world is now ruled by Rome, so which the Bible has nothing to say about the development of the Roman Empire. Political power remained largely within the priesthood. In fact, the religious authorities had fused with the civil authorities just prior to Christ. A king, call himself a king, Herod, was over Palestine. There was no king in the 5th century B.C., or 6th century B.C., when the Jews came back into Palestine. Many new and strange entities, tax collectors, synagogues, Herodians, and so on. We referred to Galatians 4 and 4, verse 4 and 5, where God says, in the fullness of time, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. When we study these things, we can really see, wow, how things came together, a common language of commerce, of education, of political exchange, that is, Greek, was pretty universal within the world, the known world. We're talking about the Mediterranean world and points east. I think it matters a lot, helps us understand much of the context of the New Testament. It adds to our understanding, I believe. The historical context, we saw the United Kingdom under Saul, David, and Solomon, roughly 1,000 B.C. for Saul, and then 960, 950 or so for David, and a little later for Solomon, obviously. Each of them ruled basically 40 years, so there's 120 years of rule under what we call the divided kingdom of Israel. After Solomon's death, the kingdom pretty quickly divided. You had 10 tribes, which became known as Israel. Also, there were a couple of other terms that were often used to stand for Israel. One of those was Ephraim, because Ephraim was one of the dominant tribes, and another was Samaria itself. Samaria, being the capital city of the northern state of Israel, was often used as a synonym for Israel. Two tribes in the south, and I'll try to speak loudly, two tribes in the south, Judah and Benjamin, retained the name of Judah. Israel fell around 722 B.C. to the Assyrians, not the Syrians, but the Assyrians, the same people of which Nineveh was the capital. Judah remained about another 100 years, a little over 100 years, and in a series of three attacks, really, starting in 606, there was another one in 597, and then the coup de grace, so to speak, in 586. The Babylonian Empire came in, first of all, exacted taxation, you would call it tribute, took some of the younger men like Daniel and others into Babylon, and then later on in the final coup, they destroyed the city of Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, killed tens of thousands of people, and took remainders into Babylonia. Nebuchadnezzar's dream, I'm not going to read all that because we've read it before, but he clearly indicates the succession of kingdoms to come after Babylonia. This was Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He was the powerful king of Babylonia at that time. Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream, in which he had this man, in a sense, a single figure. But the man had a golden head, very valuable, silver breast, bronze thighs, and then feet of iron and clay. And I think it's pretty evident that he was, in fact, he says, these are the kingdoms that will come after you. And what's really still astounding to me is that he names two of them. He names the Medo-Persians and the Greeks. He does not name the Roman Empire, but it follows and it fits the description that Daniel gives in Daniel chapter 2. You, O king, are the head of gold. He tells that to Nebuchadnezzar as he interprets the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. So this is the lineup, if you will, of the major kingdoms within the Mediterranean world, if you will, and also over to points east. Babylon, the head of gold. Chest and arms of silver, the Medo-Persian Empire, initially under Cyrus, and then later on under Darius, and then later Xerxes and others. The belly and thighs of bronze clearly indicate Greece. That would be Alexander the Great, of which we'll have much to say. Not because just interesting. It is very interesting to me. I mean, and that's one of the challenges that I have, is to sort out the things that affect Israel and Palestine. There's lots in the life of, and the adventures, if you will, the battles of Alexander the Great, but many of them don't, you know, directly affect what occurred in Palestine. The legs of iron, I believe, clearly reflect Rome. It was an assimilated former Greek holdings. The Romans were great adapters, and they loved the Greek culture, architecture, and in many cases just adopted it wholesale with virtually no change. They took the Greek gods and just gave them Roman names, Latin names, but, you know, assimilated them into their pagan worships. The rock against the feet of clay, which would destroy the last kingdom and really all of them, was the kingdom of God, which obviously includes the church. These are final instructions of Malachi, prophesying. Difference between a prediction is you've got a probability associated with it. This is 98% accurate. No, prophecies are 100% foretelling of the future. And he says that Elijah the prophet will come before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And Bible students know that to be the prophecy of John the Baptist coming before Christ. This, I would kind of memorize this just to give you yourself the battle plan, if you will, the outline of the powers. 539 to 331 represents this Persian period. Now, there was a lot going on there. Persia and Greece fought a series of wars. Greco-Persian wars went on for decades and included just amazing feats on the battle. To get, in some cases, 25, 30, 40,000 troops across a mile-wide body of water at the Hellespont. It's an amazing thing when you think of all the baggage and all of the supplies and everything that has to go with that. It's a chore today. I mean, it's a feat today to do that, much less 500 B.C. or 400 B.C. 331 is the year in which the Persian Empire fell to Alexander the Great after a series, really, of three major battles. Only took three major battles for Alexander the Great to basically defeat Persia, and it happened very, very quickly. That inaugurated the Hellenistic period. What is the Hellenistic period? Hellas was the ancient word for Greece. So Hellenistic means the Grecianation. I'm just made a word. It's the Greekizing of the world. The culture, the architecture, the language, the literature, and so on, was spread. Alexander the Great was the great Hellenizer. He loved Greece, everything Greece. Everywhere he went, he spread the culture, demanded the culture, forced his people, obviously, to speak Greek and brought the Greek language to all of these various countries that he captured. Under that are two major divisions. It's important to know. The Ptolemaic or the Egyptian period was started by Ptolemy, was one of the major generals under Alexander the Great, Ptolemy. So it lasted for 14 kingships, all directly descended, so it's a dynasty. Cleopatra, who virtually everyone has heard of, who had, you know, the affair with Mark Antony and so on, and supposedly died of a snake bite, she was a Greek. She was the last of the dynasty that had been started by Ptolemy the First, who was a general of Alexander. Seleucus, you'll also hear it pronounced Seleucus, was another Roman general that took over in Syria, just north of Palestine. And he began the Seleucid or Syrian phase of what had been the Greek Empire. Why did that occur? Because Alexander the Great, literally after all of this conquering that he had done, I'm going to show you a map in a moment, died at the age of 32 and about 10 months old, just short of 33. His death, by the way, is still mysterious. People still debate over it. You could get a PhD in describing, you know, or forecasting the death of causes of the death of Alexander. Some say he drank too much, lay on the ground, got pneumonia and died. Others say he may have been poisoned. Some say he just got some bad food and got food poisoned. But why is that important? Because he really did not line up things. He just didn't have the time. And on his deathbed, his generals come around him. There was no clear heir at the time. And they basically ask him, who gets this vast kingdom? And he said, the strongest among us. So that initiated about 30 years of battling for the kingship, for different parts of it. And two of the ones that came out, you could say the winners, were Seleucus in the north and Ptolemy in the south, and they began their empires. Now, interesting thing is that Daniel had forecast that the kingdom of Alexander the Great would eventually be divided between four. It would become four. So you also had a kingship in Greece and Macedonia, and then you had another one in Lydia, which is in northwest of what we know today as Asia Minor. 164 to 63, that's probably the least known thing. This is the Hasmonean or the Maccabean period. Very interesting to me, very interesting. I'm going to read you some of the background on that tonight. And this was an outgrowth of the incredible abuses by a king from Syria, Antiochus Epiphanes. Some pronounce it Antiochus. Where do we hear the word Antiochus? Antioch of Syria, Antioch of Pisidia, were named after this guy's father. Antiochus or Antiochus the First is also called Antiochus the Great. His son, Antiochus the Fourth, we're going to get into this later, was just an absolute disaster. And I believe that he did what Daniel calls the abomination in the book of Daniel. And what was that? That was sacrificing swine, sows, on the altar, not just once or twice, but for a period of 3 years, totally defiling the temple. And that caused and initiated, or spurred, you could say, the revolt against that, which led to a very long war. And for a while, from about 164 to 63 BC, there was relative independence of the Israel state. They still paid taxes to Syria, but they weren't under the thumb of the Syrian king. Then the Roman period starts in 63 BC when the Roman general Pompey, who was known in history as a great general, got done with his task of subduing the pirates on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, said, hey, I still got 3 or 4 months, marches in, takes over Jerusalem, institutes Roman reign into Israel. And, of course, the Romans are who we see in control at the dawn of the first New Testament days. The periods between the Testaments, this is kind of review, the remnant of Jews returned to Jerusalem in the Persian period, and what is referred to very often in literature as the Second Temple period. The First Temple period would be during the temple that Solomon had built in his reign. The Grecian period again included Hellenization, from the word Hellas for Greece. The Septuagint translation in Alexandria. Ptolemy II. So remember, Ptolemy I also took the nickname Soter, which is Greek for savior of all things. So he, the first general that took over in Egypt, called himself Ptolemy I Soter. His son, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, similar to our city, was, by I think most accounts, a very reasonable king, great builder, very interested in art and literature, and under his kingship, the great library in Alexandria, named for Alexander, of course, the great library was created, and they started trying to collect the scrolls, the ancient scrolls from all over the world. If they didn't have the scroll itself, they'd try to get a copy of it. And by this time, many people were speaking Greek, because remember, Alexander the Great had conquered this area several decades before. And just think of it in our country, how, I was thinking about this morning, I think, how people come from, let's say, Europe. They speak another language, whatever it may be, Polish or Italian, whatever. They come, they start learning English themselves. By the second generation, they're very fluent in English. By the third or fourth generation, I mean, English is their adopted language. And so that's very much what you saw there. By 60, 70, 80 years of Hellenization, most of the people knew and could use Greek. The Jewish independence period, we're going to talk some length about that, and then the Roman period. Apocrypha, I'm not going to go into detail on this. This is a whole big study, but it represented 14 additional books written between the Old Testament and the New Testament. They're not inspired. They don't make the claim of being inspired. They're never quoted in the New Testament. The reason I mention it, you'll see programs on this. The Catholic Bible uses some of the Apocrypha in it. And we could perhaps have a whole other study on that later on. I would say this, they do provide some uninspired history, and they're very interesting. I'm going to read some of it tonight from the Maccabean, First Maccabees, which we believe was compiled in about 140 B.C. By people down in the northern coast of Africa. The Old Testament was translated into Greek. That's called the Septuagint. We refer to it many times. It's quoted roughly 300 times in the New Testament by Christ himself. So he obviously gives credence to the Septuagint. It also helps explain why sometimes a quote in the New Testament will not be exactly the same as it was in the Hebrew Bible, you know, because you've got different, you know, slightly different meanings. Some words are a little bit, have difference of opinion of the people who are interpreting it. And that's why very often it won't be an exact quote. Jesus giving credence to the Septuagint, I believe, is important. It shows what? That different versions are acceptable. We have different versions today. You could say they're not 100% accurate, and you have to watch some of them that have a premillennial bent to them. You have to be very careful with that. In that case, they become not real translations, but really commentaries of somebody who believes in the, some version of premillennialism. But what it did is it provided the Greek translation to the Jews and Gentile proselytes, such as Cornelius, who was described as a God-fearer. The legend of a name, this is new for us. The name from Septuagint derives from a legend that 72 or 70 scholars from all 12 tribes of Israel translated the first five books in 72 days. However, the northern tribes were dispersed by the Assyrians. Remember that in 722. Assyria took many of those people in northern Israel to various countries and brought in people from other countries into Samaria and northern Israel. So that by very soon after that, only three tribes were likely present in, you might say, a pure form, and accounted for in the 3rd century. Most scholars believe the Greek-speaking Jews in Alexandria, Egypt, performed this translation between the 3rd and 1st centuries B.C. So some controversy on that. Did Philadelphus do it earlier than that, or was it done by Jewish-speaking people, Jews speaking Greek in Alexandria? Three centers of Jewish life eventually formed. First, of course, Jerusalem. Very important for the appearance of two important sects, the Pharisees and Sadducees, of which I'll have more to say later. Babylon, the Jews in Babylon. There were a lot of Jews who chose to stay in Babylon. We sometimes think that they all wanted to come back. A lot of them didn't. They had become merchants. Just think of it. They had children, grandchildren, perhaps even great-grandchildren. They were given some freedoms in Babylon. They weren't slaves. And some of them just said, you know what? We're not going to go back to Jerusalem. We're going to stay in Babylon. So it became a center of Judaism. They had returned to monotheism, that is, Jehovah. You also had the rise of rabbis and scribes. It's generally believed that the rabbis, not mentioned in the Old Testament, that they arose in Babylon because, again, they were away from the temple and they became the teachers along with the scribes in Babylon. Alexandria had a very large population of Jews. The library there that was built, definitely the library was built by Philadelphus, was a center of learning and the production of the Septuagint there we've already mentioned. Between the Testaments, Daniel 8 talks about a ram which had two horns, and he even identifies that as the Medo-Persian Empire. The two horns represent two kings, the first one being Cyrus, the one who allowed the Jews to come back into Jerusalem, and then Darius, the successor to Cyrus. So who were they? They were the first two Persian kings. A male goat came from the west, crossed the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. I think it's clearly Alexander the Great, and again, Daniel identifies him as coming from Greece. And he basically rams into the ram, destroying the ram, which is a great graphic illustration of what occurred. I saw him, that is Alexander, confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. And again, it wasn't immediate. It took about 30 years for those four rulers to consolidate and kill off their enemies, killed off all the successors of Alexander. Let's call them possible successors. At the time Alexander died, he had married a woman from Parthia, I believe it was, named Roxana, kind of a modern name. And she was pregnant with what turned out to be a son at the time that he died. Roxana's sister, the baby, Alexander the Fourth, they were all killed. Just to remove, that's what they did back there, to remove any pretext of a contender for the throne. The Persian post-exilic period from 536 to 331 also saw the Aramaic language develop. Now, that's a Semitic language. What's another example of a Semitic language? Hebrew. So Aramaic was similar in many ways to Hebrew, and generally I think a lot of people, like for Hebrews, could understand a lot of Aramaic and maybe not speak it fluently, just like languages are today. But Aramaic was a very common language by the time of Christ, and a few passages in the Old Testament are in Aramaic, and a few words, I believe, I should have looked this up, but I think Eli's the last words of Christ, aren't they? Aramaic, they're Aramaic. Eli, Sabachthani. I think that's an Aramaic phrase that Jesus used, just to illustrate the use of Aramaic in that time. The Persian Empire, I think, is clearly identified with the chest and arms of silver. That's the empire that came after which one? Babylonian Empire. It's also identified with the bear and a ram in different visions that Daniel explains in his book. This is very interesting. It's called the Cyrus Cylinder. It's now in the British Museum, the actual cylinder. It's written in Babylonian cuneiform. Cuneiform was a way where they would take a clay that was not yet hardened, and they took a stylus, which was triangular shaped on the end. So it's like a pencil, but the blunt end of the pencil is a triangle. And so by digging that pencil, think of it, or that stylus into that clay, you could make different images and letters and so on, and then the clay would harden. There are just thousands of these clay tablets that have been discovered now in the major Babylonian cities, including Babylon itself, Susa, and other cities of Babylon. But at any rate, this cylinder, it's called, records the decree of Cyrus the Great, that first king of Persia, to allow Jews to return to Jerusalem. Now, it wasn't only Jews. I taught myself this. He allowed many of his, all of his conquered people, basically, to return to their homes. In other words, he showed, what would you call, grace to them, in a sense. If they wanted to go home, they could go home. He didn't treat them like slaves, as most emperors or kings did in those days. The first return was under Zerubbabel, a governor that was appointed to lead those 40,000 Jews back. And then later, Ezra and Nehemiah came in and, you know, led the rebuilding of the temple, and with Nehemiah, the rebuilding of the walls. Very, very similar. This just blows my mind, too. This is from Isaiah 44 and 45, written roughly 740 B.C. So we're talking about 200 years prior to the Jews coming back to Palestine at the allowance, if you will, of Cyrus the Great. In Isaiah 44, 28, it says, "It is I," quoting God, "who says of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and he will perform all my desire. And he declares of Jerusalem, she will be built, and of the temple, your foundation will be laid." Perfect description of what occurred. The temple was started, memory serves now, about 535 B.C., but it got a lot of opposition. If you remember, Sanballat and others, the Samaritans, were kept opposing it and all. And, well, that was the wall, but there was a lot of opposition. So the building went on about 10 years, and then it paused for about 10 years and was later completed, I believe, in 521, if memory serves. But the foundation was definitely laid under the kingship of Cyrus. 45:1 says, "Thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed, who I've taken by the right hand to subdue nations before him and to loose the lions for kings," and so on. Notice he says, "I will give you the treasures of the darkness and hidden wealth of secret places in order that you may know it." And Persia became fabulously wealthy, more than any empire prior to that time, from looting the holy places, not only of places they conquered, but also just getting taxes in from the people that they captured. This was so interesting, I had to put this in here. Who was Cyrus the Great? This is the man, the king, that allowed the Jews to come back into Jerusalem. And not only did that, but supported them with money and decrees to support them in the rebuilding of the city and the walls. He defeated Babylon and Lydia. He allowed Jews and other captive people, wasn't just the Jews, to return to their lands. Now, he was followed by Xerxes, who, and I'll say this is somewhat controversial, but the consensus, I believe, is that Xerxes was also called Ahasuerus, who was the king who later married Esther. Now, he would have come along around 500 B.C., you know, after Cyrus. Xerxes also fought notable battles against Greece. He was kind of around. He said, "Well, I can fight Greece." He takes his troops across the Hellespont, about a mile wide, goes down into Greece, is defeated roundly, comes back, and in that third chapter of Esther, you're looking at a changed man. And that's where he apparently, you know, reaches out and eventually takes Esther as queen. The Cyrus decree we've already referred to, and the picture I showed you. His reign, that is Cyrus's reign, is described by Herodotus, a Greek historian, Xenophon, also Greek, and Ctesias, who was on the Ionian, as I recall. But I just wanted to read this. This was equally high praise for Cyrus's legacy as found in modern times at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. There on display is a replica of what's called the Cyrus cylinder, which I showed you a picture of. Written in Babylonian cuneiform around the time of Cyrus's conquest of the city, that is of Babylon, and unearthed in its ruins by British archaeologists in 1879, the cylinder chronicles Cyrus's numerous acts of mercy. It describes his willingness to let conquered subjects retain their traditions, that would also include religion, of course, a practice unheard of in a time when rulers, quote, owned not only the conquered lands, but also the people living in them. The cylinder is generally regarded as the, quote, the first bill of human rights, and Cyrus's reign exemplary for ruling with pluralism and tolerance. Now, why is that important to me? Because while Herodotus and Statius are not inspired writers, they are historians, and what they wrote is entirely consistent with what we see in the Bible. Again, to me, it's just one of those things that says, yeah, that's what I would have expected of contemporaneous or near contemporaneous historians who were anywhere near accurate. The remnant of Israel in Jerusalem, the first return was led by Zerubbabel. We know that in Ezra 1 and 3. They rebuild the temple starting about 536 to 530. They have a long delay. They complete it in about, we think, 516 B.C. And again, I'll say this many times, always the dates are a little squishy. I mean, you'll go to some source and they'll have different numbers there. There's the reading of the law under Ezra, where he takes everybody out. You recall that scene, he has them standing up and he's reading the law, and they're all saying, you know, amen, and agreeing to follow the law again. And you see the rebuilding of the walls under Nehemiah, great story of leadership there. And we see the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and Haggai all occurring or referring to events in that period of time. Significant Persian events. Cyrus the Great allows Jews to return. Darius the First is defeated at Mount Athos and Marathon. Does the name Marathon ring a bell? This is where the Greek runner was running to give a message to one of the generals, and he ran, you know, nonstop. What was it, 26.2 miles? Is that the marathon route? And that was kind of became the standard for the marathon. Now, our sister Evelyn, I think, only runs half marathons. Is that right? Oh, she runs the full one. Oh, I stand corrected. I'm humbled in my incorrect. Xerxes, which I believe is Ahasuerus. He's identified by many scholars as Ahasuerus in Esther 1 and 2, bridged the Hellespont. He was going after the Greeks. There's a great book out there called Every War Must End. And you know, one generation beats the other country, and then the next country rises up and said, man, we're going out there and beating that first, you know, the country. And so it never ends unless one country really just kind of exterminates or scares to death their enemy. But in this case, Xerxes bridges the Hellespont and was defeated at Thermopylae. That's the great story where the Spartan 300 stand in this small mountain gap for days to give time for the Greek forces to come up, and they're just fighting right down to the last man. And the only way Xerxes got around them was a spy from the Greek side said, oh, there's a trail around the mountains, and they took another trail, finally got around there. But the Spartan 300 held him up a long time. And then he was defeated again at Salamis in a great naval battle. That wasn't the total defeat of Persia, though. Xerxes goes back, and we believe then takes Esther as queen, and he's defeated later on completely at two battles called Mycale and Plataka, I believe is the pronunciation, in 479 B.C. So we kind of get that straight. If we take 540 as time for the Jews coming back to Israel, this would be what, roughly 40 plus 20, about 60 years, two and a half generations from the time the Jews came back. And it's under Xerxes that the Ezra restores the law in Jerusalem and Nehemiah builds the walls in Jerusalem. See, that's not clear to me. It hadn't been in other studies. You kind of think, oh, the Jews come back and they start building the walls and they start building the temple, but there's some time delay before that is all done. Was it? Let me check that. I looked it up. I thought I had it right. Darius the Third. Now remember, Darius was the second king. Darius the First. You had Cyrus. You had Darius the First. So we're all the way down to Darius the Third here. Is defeated by Alexander the Great in 331 B.C. So let's start talking a bit more about Alexander. We've got about 10 minutes here. The rise of Macedonia. Macedonia is the northern province of Greece. I've got it on a map later on. Let me just maybe show you the map. You see Macedonia on the left, upper left part of this slide. Macedonia was the hinterlands of Greece. They're very ancient people, and there's still a dispute today about where the Macedonians came from. They were very warlike and you know, strong people. They were considered by the Greeks as barbarians. Ba-ba is what the Greeks said. They said, oh, when the Macedonians talk, all I hear is ba-ba, ba-ba, you know, and that got morphed into barbarian. So a barbarian was somebody that goes around saying ba-ba-ba, you know, and then later took on more sinister meaning, so to speak. But Macedonia was growing up steadily, and under the king Philip II, they discovered great wealth in silver mines. They had conquered a small area up there that has silver mines. So all of a sudden they have access to tons and tons of silver. They used it to build up the army. They used it to build elaborate buildings within Macedonia. They were Greek, but they were sort of the country Greek, if you will. Philip II, who is Alexander's father, took his throne in 359 B.C. and reorganized the army. He was a big-time soldier, brave from all accounts. He using great wealth from silver mines. He perfected the Macedonian phalanx, which, if you've ever studied military history, the Greeks adopted the Greek phalanx. What it was like a tank of people. He had a row of maybe 20 soldiers with a huge metal shield, and they, you know, marched in like a tank. The others behind them with long pikes that they could bring down and run through the enemy. He greatly admired, that is Philip II, greatly admired Greek culture and wanted to unify the land. He thought that Alexander, as Alexander was coming up, was not getting a good education. I don't know where he was going. But he brought in a guy named Aristotle, you know. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle's the third guy. I remember that with the acronym SPA, you know, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. Brings in Aristotle as your personal tutor. So Alexander the Great, I say that to say this, he had broad interests. He was interested in science, art, literature, history, of course, and so was enamored with the Greek culture and everything that he really took it and forced it on people that he later conquered. The Macedonians quickly conquered every major city-state, certainly including Sparta and Athens. And they had been weakened themselves for many decades of fighting each other. So that certainly helped Philip II come in and conquer them. He was very generous to those who surrendered. If they surrendered, he said, hey, you can keep your leaders. You're going to pay taxes and so on, but just kind of go on about your business. But you're going to be within my reign, if you will. Philip's conquest might have continued, but he was assassinated in 336 B.C. by a trusted bodyguard. They were literally getting up a big parade. He had a bodyguard around him, and one of his bodyguards comes up, runs him through, and then runs off. And, of course, the rest of the bodyguard go after that guy and killed him, but he's dead. His son, now Alexander, is 20 years old, becomes king. Now, Alexander was not a kid. He had been in the army himself since the age of 14, and at the age of 18 had led a cavalry charge in one of these battles that his father had with, you know, down in Greece with one of the city-states. So he was well prepared, and he hated Persians. I mean, you talk about a machine. All he wanted to do was to get the Persians. He hated them, and he went quickly after them. This is Philip of Macedon, bust on the left, bad day on the right, had one of his eyes put out, and I think this is an actor that played him in one of the documentaries. Although some early Greek states had democracies, classical democracy was back in the 5th century of Greece. A powerful monarchy had gained dominance in the 4th century B.C., that is in Macedonia, under their greatest king, Alexander III, the Greeks conquered most of the Middle East. And it's just staggering. I'm going to show you the map. We've got 4 minutes left. It is staggering the extent of the empire that Alexander had, of course, at its height. And then he comes back to Babylon and within a year or two dies. Greek influence and the Greek language spread with it. The Hellenistic period was begun under Alexander the Great of Macedon. He was born in 356, And his father died in 336, so roughly, again, 20 years old. But notice he died in 323. So, you know, a very short time after, well, less than 13 years after he became king. Aristotle was his tutor. His mother was an interesting character. She was, now again, this is in one of the Greek historians, said that she slept with snakes, and that her husband, Philip II, actually saw it one time and never trusted her afterwards. The snake, by the way, was one of the symbols of Zeus, you know, the top god with a little g. And Olympias was her name, and she claimed that Alexander, now the baby, was actually fathered by Zeus. So he was a demigod and would never die. Now that's kind of important to some of the later events here. But Aristotle was his tutor. He had a strong, well-trained, and extremely loyal soldiers under his command. Alexander still studied today in military colleges for his various maneuvers and so on. He was said to have an incredible eye to get up on a high point and watch a battle develop and recognize where the weak spots were or where the spots were that he could, you know, exploit. And he would lead the charge himself. I mean, he didn't just stay back. But he was on his horse and very often would lead a cavalry charge, come in from the side and wipe out the enemy. He was brave and brilliant in that regard. He defeated the Persian Empire, died at age 33, actually just short of it. His kingdom was divided into four parts among his generals, which completely fits the prophecy of Daniel back that we've said. He, I believe, is the belt and thighs of bronze. He's also the leopard and the goat in the various visions there. I'll close on this. Well, no, I want to get this picture in. Notice where Macedonia is in the top left segment. This is northern Greece. Alexander came all the way down through modern-day Turkey, all the way down into through Israel, into Egypt, and went way out in the desert of what is now Libya. There was an oasis out there called the Siwi, and there was supposedly a seer, you know, a prophet, if you will. Alexander wanted to find out if he really was a demigod or not, if his father was Zeus. So he goes out there with a large bodyguard. Took days to get out there. Gets to this oasis, and as I read the story, the first guy that greeted him said, "Well, the seer's not available." Alexander says, "Make him available." So they bring the seer in. Alexander comes in with his retinue and says, "I want you to consult the gods and tell me, am I a son of Zeus?" So that, you know, the seer does what seers do and comes back and says, "Oh yeah." He says, you're son of Zeus. And Alexander believed it and believed from that point that he could not die. Of course, he was proven wrong roughly 10 years later. But I want to end on this note. So he comes down in Egypt, comes back up through Jerusalem, and there's a tremendous account of what happened in Jerusalem. All of his closest companions thought that he was just going to level Jerusalem, destroy the temple and everything. He didn't. And there's a great account of why that did not occur. So he goes all the way down into Babylon, fights the last major battle right there where, if I can get this going. Oh, yeah. For some reason, this doesn't show up on it. See where the 331 is? That was Gaugamela. That was the last big battle where Persia now fell. He comes on down, goes all the way over to India, crosses the Indus River, crosses the other river on east of Indus, fights a battle there, and his men are saying, "Too much. We've been out here 7 years. We got to go back." And some writers say they were about to mutiny. So he says, "Okay, we're going to go back." So he goes back to Babylon, sets himself up as a great king, gets, you know, soft, for example, brings in a lot of concubines and so on, and then eventually dies at the age of just short of 33 years old. The last thing I want to tell you, to put this into perspective, I actually looked up the air miles between New York City and L.A. It's 2,800 miles. Using this scale here, from Macedonia to where he went into India, it was 3,600 miles. Farther than the air miles from New York to L.A. by a good long shot. And did it in ancient times, you know, with horses and wagons and pillaging as he went, but and never had more than about 35,000 troops, and was virtually always outnumbered 2 or 3 to 1 or even more in his battles. He was just absolutely brilliant. All right, thank you. I'm a minute over. Lord willing, we'll pick up there, give you a little more about Alexander and why he was important to what later happens in Palestine.